Today I'm talking with David Weekly, who I've actually watched him from afar for a number of years. He's a very smart guy in the Bay Area. And David's working on a number of interesting things. He actually runs PB Wiki, which is short for Peanut Butter Wiki, which I happen to know because that is one of the things that we use to publish Meat Innovators interviews. I bet you didn't know that, Dave.
No, I didn't. I'm very glad that you're using it.
Yep, so we're a user. We can talk about that in the interview. But before we go and talk about what you're currently doing, Dave, why don't you just tell us a little bit about who you are and where you come from?
Sure. Well, I'm very much a nerd by birth as much by training. I started programming at the age of five. My dad was a...
At the age of five? I would like trying to learn to talk when I was five.
We just had an Apple PC laying around the house. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I just kind of copied in the programming column that were in the back of the kids' magazines that I was getting at the time. But my father's father, his job title is actually computer. So I'm rather literally the descendant of a computer. So this stuff is very directly in my blood. I started programming very early, as mentioned, and did actually some work in high school for MIT Lincoln Labs and Harvard Physics Labs, and then went to Stanford as an undergraduate, got my degree in computer science. So I didn't really have a hard time deciding what I wanted to major in. And graduated in 2000. For a big company, worked for a small company, and then meant to go start my own company. Involved in a lot of different kinds of things. I was very involved with computer graphics and then computer audio undergraduate. And I believe I wrote the first layman's level description for what MP3 was in the spring of 1997.
Hmm. Yeah, you touched a lot on your website, haven't you?
Yeah, I started that website in 1996 when I was still in high school, about to join Stanford. Yeah. So I first got on the internet around 1990 through my father's email account at GenRad. So I remember back when, this must have been like 92 or so, they actually had a book published that had everybody's email address that was on the internet. And I was very proud because I was in that book.
Oh, really? Well, that's pretty serious. I mean, I think I might have you by a year. I think I got on the internet in 1989. But I definitely wasn't in that book. I didn't have an email address until like 1993.
Got it. Did you mean 1989?
1989, yeah.
Yeah, got it. Cool. Very cool.
But I'm out of books, so I mean, I guess my calling factor's gone down a little bit.
Dropped in Boston, came out here for Stanford, and then have been in the area since then. Very much enjoying it.
And so you had a pedigree where you come out, and I mean, you should be like a Google founder or a Yahoo founder. I guess that's what you're looking to do, huh?
Well, you know, I'm really enjoying the entrepreneurial band. This stuff freaking runs in the water at Stanford. Certainly back when I was there in 96 to 2000, everybody was involved in some sort of startup in some sort of way. It was just what people did.
Mm.
Yeah, so it felt pretty natural to me that at some point I would go and start my own company. That became really clear to me when I was working at Legato before they got bought by EMC.
Mm-hmm.
And for fun, in my free time, I ported the company's flagship product to Mac OS X. And I got yelled at for it. My manager wanted me to be really grateful to him that I was shielding him, that he was shielding me from the wrath of the other managers for working on an unauthorized side project. And I found out the day that I left that the salespeople had actually been selling multi-million-dollar contracts based on that OS export. And I knew at that point that in order to get a slice of the value that I was creating as a computer scientist, I need to start my own company.
Yeah, right. So you graduated and you hit the corporate world for a year, is that right?
Yeah, I think at that point, I've been involved with a lot of startups, especially around digital audio. So I think everyone was kind of expecting me to go to an audio startup. And so I didn't really want to get put into a box. I wanted to be respected as a computer scientist. I did the last thing anyone expected me to do, and to go work for a large corporate enterprise backup company. That was Legato.
I that sounds like about the most boring thing you could do in the entire world.
Well, you know, it's funny, because I think it was definitely worth doing. There's some things that large, old software companies do really well that startups don't give a lot of respect to, like really understanding computer systems engineering, understanding build process and tests and QA, and really getting that into one's blood is really important. There are a lot of things that they do very badly, like middle management. There's some component of Dilbert world going on there, where the people whose full-time job seems to strictly consist of playing politics with other people, whose full-time job was to play internal politics. So it's kind of a wonder that anything got done there. But there were... it was definitely an important part of my education that I don't regret at all. I was deliberately doing something different than what was expected of me, and it's been very, very helpful. PB Wiki has actually begun to transition into being an enterprise software company.
Well, certainly talk about that. So you spent a year there, and then where did you go after that?
After that, I went to go work for a very different kind of company called Vayr.com. It was an online virtual world. They're actually still around. Their most direct competitor is Second Life. So this is a place where you go and it's a full screen app, and it looks kind of like a game, but it's not a game. It's not like World of Warcraft. You don't have hit points. You can't die. You're not killing monsters. You're just hanging out with other people in this 3D world. You can go and do things with them. You can chat with them. You can buy virtual merchandise so you can make your character look like whatever you want them to look like. But it's not like a game where you're building up points by killing bad guys.
Hmm. And so what kind of coding were you doing there?
So I did a bunch of different coding there, including optimizing and managing their clusters of computers, making the forums much faster, and I did the 3D audio jukebox in the world. So if you sign on at some point at Vayr.com and see a jukebox that's playing music in 3D, that's actually my work. That was the first 3D shoutcast implementation. but then run it over them.
So you like to be able to just write code around anything. I mean, if you're doing graphics and sound, all that sort of stuff, that's fairly non-trivial programming.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy things that affect people, that make a difference in people's lives, that they can see, they can hear, they can experience.
Hmm. Why did you not go to work for someplace like Electronic Arts?
What I was looking for moving out of Legato was a kind of extreme transition to something else. To be put in an environment where I was surrounded by people who were a lot smarter than I was. And I frankly wasn't really finding that at Legato. and there.com offered me that. It was still to this day the most intensely brilliant team of technologists that I've ever seen assembled before. A lot of that was due to the CTO, Ken Duda, who by hand pieced together the engineering team. He interviewed about 100 engineers for every one he'd hire. It was really intensive. What was crazy about that company was how secret they kept everything. I had to go through and pass 5 rounds of interviews before they would even tell me what the company did. Mm-hmm. They were in stealth beta for a long time before they launched.
How did that keep you interested enough to go through that many interviews without knowing about them?
The interviews were with people who were clearly smarter than I was. And at that point was pretty rare for me to find somebody who was just whole giant heads in field and leagues ahead of me in their technical depth and knowledge. These were people who had written a good part of operating system BOS. They're very, very hardcore folks. And so it's like the quality of the interviews was intensive and very enjoyable. And it was clear that if I went to go work there, I'd be surrounded by people who I could learn a lot from.
Hmm. All right. How long did you stay there for?
I was there for about a year and a half. And then,
so tell me how it went. I mean, if they got the technology guys right and the company hadn't been a big success, was it the management problem? Was the business model not right? What was it about it that didn't get to where it should have been?
Wait, so I think there's a couple different factors. I think there's some question as to whether a free, full-screen, immersive communications environment that's not a game can ever really be successful. I think that mentally, a lot of the communications media that have succeeded in the last decade or so have been what I call background roles. So you take a look at like IM, SMS, email, any of these things that have become widely successful, and there are things that you can do while working on other things. There are tasks that are backgroundable. You don't have to be fully immersed, fully engaged in that thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But something that's a full-screen application where you can't really be doing other things at the same time, that really demands all your attention. It's not something that's backgroundable. And so it's not a way that you would casually go and interact with other people. It'd be the only thing that you'd be doing. So it's not something you could do, for instance, at work. You can keep in touch with people at work using such a full-screen technology. You need to like, set aside time. And that time needs to be synchronized with when other people, the people you want to go chat with, are also setting aside that time. And that, I think, ends up really limiting the level of participation and the number of participants that you can get online and the degree to which the experience is compelling.
Hmm.
I think that people are willing to set aside time to play a game. They're willing to make a game be their full-screen, full-time experience. We'll sort of track out, like, okay, I'm going to go and play World of Warcraft after I get home from work tonight in between 7:30 and 9 p.m. Right? I'm just going to go and play it for an hour and a half. And they've kind of chalked that time off if we're gooting off. It ends up, almost by accident, becoming a communications medium where they're connecting with other people and building social relationships. But it's a game first, and the social aspects end up becoming more interesting part after you've effectively beaten the game.
So the point of their one, was that supposed to be like, their.com, that was to hook up with your friends. It wasn't supposed to be like a big game or something.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's a place where you could go in and do things in a virtual space with your friends and get to know them better online.
Right.
But it wasn't a game. There weren't quests. You didn't go and, you know, slay monsters. And I think it sort of needed to be a game.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Huh, okay. So it was a business model issue.
Yeah, I think that was part of it. I think also the whole secrecy for 5.5 years before they went into public beta was also a bad idea. I mean, my current philosophy on how businesses succeed now is distinctly opposite of that. I think that in order to make the right thing, you need to get the simplest possible thing out there in front of people, hear what they say about it, and iterate it along with your customers versus trying to make this big, perfect, wonderful thing in secret. I think that's just a bad idea.
Maybe people didn't realize that as much back then, but I mean, another to that line, the saying I know is that the first version you put out of something is always going to be the worst version, and you're just going to get better from there.
That's right, but it's important that you get started on that process of getting better as soon as possible. I mean, I think you should take the simplest possible incarnation of your idea and just put it out there. I think a lot of innovators have a problem that they're too smart. They've got this really complex, overarching, interesting, and comprehensive vision for what the product is going to become someday, and they want to build a whole thing before they show it off to people.
Right.
Because otherwise, the full impact of it won't be understood by the audience. And as a result, they end up handicapping themselves. They end up spending years working on something before putting it out there, and then it turns out that what they put out was the wrong thing.
I know that now, and all the people I work with online know that. Are you seeing that in a valley? Are people understanding that, or are they still not get it?
I feel like entrepreneurs who have been around the block, who've gotten some skin knees, understand it intuitively. It's something I still see as a problem in new entrepreneurs, that they've got this big, wonderful, awesome, overarching vision, and they're looking to build a whole team to implement a whole thing before they launch any part of it. And sometimes they need some sense beaten into them, that they just need to launch the simplest possible thing that could work.
Well, they don't even need to beat into them, but you don't have to do it yourself. Their market will do that for them.
Right, but I mean, out of a desire to save them a few years of doing the wrong thing.
I think a really interesting example of that is actually Intermix, which was the company that owned MySpace. Do you know that story?
I'd be happy to hear from you.
Just that they were doing internet offers. They're selling Hydroderm, which is a wrinkle cream. They did a bunch of other stuff. They had a lot of traffic inventory. They were doing all kinds of like email and all sorts of stuff like that. And then some of the guys in the team just had this idea for a little site to compete with Friendster. And they plugged it into the rest of their network so that it would get users. And the idea was that they would create their own traffic inventory so that they could run their own offers against their own traffic. And then suddenly that blossomed, and the rest of the company became basically almost meaningless. And they jettisoned it all and became MySpace. I actually spoke today with the guy who bought the rest of their stuff, and like the Hydroderm stuff is still going. It's about a $40-50 million a year business, but you know, nothing compared to MySpace.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of modern companies actually have this. I mean, take a look at what PayPal is founding, and they were doing palm pilot encrypted money transfers. Right?
Exactly. That's the perfect example.
You take a look at Flickr, and that was just meant to be the photo upload portion of this online adventure game. It wasn't actually meant to be a photo sharing service.
No, I didn't know that one.
You take a look at Fly.com's origins, and this was a Windows application that's meant to sit on your desktop for doing catalog shopping, so you sort of like passively browse catalogs as a Windows application. Now they're, you know, the number one Facebook application provider. And, you know, Craigslist was just this guy's mailing list. It wasn't even any technology at all.
Yeah.
So it's really fascinating how these things that start off really simple, almost as an accident, a design project, something else, end up becoming really successful and really catching up. So the market will tell you what it needs, and that's why I think it's really important to get out there as fast as possible.
I agree. But the other thing that, as a side to that is you've got to have the resources to take advantage of the opportunity when it comes. Like MySpace guys, they had all the resources. They had the ability to send out emails so friends could invite their friends. They had traffic so they could plug it into all this massive inventory and gain traction really quickly. Whereas, you know, if you don't have the resources behind you, the opportunity will just whiz by.
I feel like the amount of resources that you need to be able to take advantage of opportunities like this has just gotten increasingly small.
True.
Yeah, but like, an entrepreneur comes to me and doesn't have something implemented and is looking for advice on how they can secure a VC round, it's just like, I tell them to sit down for a reality check, because if they can't come to a VC round with an already launched product with real customers, then they're going to get left out of the room.
That's an interesting topic, because I've been talking with people. The general consensus seems to be that the VC model is going away for internet stuff, and I was reading in the Wall Street Journal yesterday about Sequoia Capital is starting to do some stuff with endowment funds and things like that. What are you seeing?
I mean, what I'm seeing is that what was traditionally thought of as Series A investment has become sort of friends and family, and what it was traditionally thought of as Series B investment or expansion capital is becoming Series A investment. So the price points are the same, but the stages are different. What do I mean by this? What I mean is that $98.99, you could come to a VC looking for a Series A round, looking to raise like $5 million based on an idea and the team, and you could just have like some quick, you know, whiteboard sketches of what you were looking to build. You wouldn't even need to have like a functional prototype or anything. And then by the time you got to your Series B, it was expected that you'd actually launch a product, you're actually making some revenue, you didn't need to be cash flow positive, and you were looking to raise like $10, $20 million or something, right? And that's sort of what the different rounds meant. These days, you know, you're doing your Series A, you're raising like anywhere between $2 and $10 million. It used to be like they wouldn't even talk to you if you're looking to raise like $2 million. And you're expected to already have a product that's out there, that's got customers, that ideally has a small amount of revenue. And that's the first time that you're, you know, talking with serious institutional finance. You already have all that stuff built.
So you still see a place for this. You still go out and raise. Did you raise money for your current company?
Yeah, February last year we raised a Series B from our dividend.
So you still see a place for VC. You still want to go and get money.
Yeah, so it's just later stage. Like, I don't think it makes sense anymore to come to VC with just an idea for a web startup. I think they'll left you out of the room. Yeah, I think they're looking for things that have a lot more polish, a lot more finish on them before you go and then start raising.
But I mean, a lot of the companies that I talk to, like lead generation or mass market offers or whatever else, they're already cash flow positive as soon as they get started, and they can scale up as big as the numbers of support. They have no use for VC. I mean, you still feel there is some.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. So I mean, I think that having advance on your capital, first off, is really, really helpful. It lets you go and scale up faster than the competition. It lets you go and build out a sales team, marketing team, hire engineers. I think that even still, you know, having VC financing also just makes a lot of little things easier. Knowing that your VC back will make it a little bit easier to hire employees and make it a little bit easier to get partnership deals. We found a lot of things just work a little bit more smoothly when people know that you have the backing of a real institution, and, you know, versus possibly being or not being solvent if you're just on your own finances.
What about a point, one guy told me that if your VCs are looking for home runs, and if you're able to sell for $300 million, if you're only able to sell for $10 million, for example, or $20 million, that VCs want minorities more liquid at that in their portfolio, so they'd rather the company just keep struggling along rather than taking a loss on it or a break-even. And therefore, you don't get a cash out.
Yeah, I think that is a reasonable point, but there is actually a flip side to that same point. That's that a lot of entrepreneurs, and myself included, come into it thinking, oh, you know, I've got a $10, $20 million company idea. And what the VCs are very helpful with is opening your eyes as to ways that you could go and become much bigger than that. Does that make sense?
So you think that the VCs are helping you think of ways to scale a company?
Absolutely. When I started PewWiki, I would have been delighted to know that there was a possibility that it could become a $5 or $10 million company. But I think that dealing with RBCs has really been tremendously helpful in opening my eyes to realizing that, no, this could become a billion-dollar company, and working with me to establish a roadmap for how we could become that big.
So, I mean, what kind of things did they help you with planning? I mean, did you need to take capital from that? I mean, couldn't you have just gotten that same advice from a board of advisors or just some friends?
Well, somebody who's really got their skin in the game is going to spend a lot vested in making sure that you make the right decisions, that your thinking is clear, and is going to be willing to spend a fair amount of time with you. The people who have on board with us from more day-to-day have a lot of experience doing this kind of thing, can do all kinds of pattern matching that I wouldn't necessarily have been able to get out of my existing circle of advisors.
Hmm. So they've actually extended your network, is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So we talked about then the graphic, the Bear.com. What company did you, what did you do after that?
So at Bear.com, after I'd been there for a year and a half, I was actually the first engineer to voluntarily leave the company in the 6 years of its operating history. So I stood up in the middle of a company meeting, and I said, hey, I really enjoyed working with you all, but I need to go start my own company. So I wish you all the best, and I'd love to nudge you. Bye. But it happens that a month after I quit Bear.com, the CEO got fired, and things got really messy, and then the company kind of imploded in a very messy, dramatic, and fascinating way, including a 72-to-1 reverse stock split from a largely employee-financed company that had held $45 million in cash. So things got surprising and awkward.
And we thought it was all your fault because you left.
No, but people did say I had rather prescient timing. I knew at that point that if I continued to work at Bear.com, I'd become an incrementally better engineer, but that the overall value that I'd be able to provide a world would not be rocketing up. That I was sort of reaching the point of diminishing returns on my career investment as a software engineer. And I was talking with other people about different places to go at that point, including an advisor from college professor who I had there, a wonderful professor, who wanted me to go and get a PhD in computer science. I talked with a PhD in computer science and determined pretty quickly that that wasn't what I wanted to do. Took a look at going to business school, talked to some people in business school who all really enjoyed it. But they said, look, if what you're trying to do is understand how to run a business, business school ain't bad, but the best possible thing you can do is start your own business.
Right.
Okay. So I read a couple of business books and I just hired off to go start my own business.
And what business was that?
Well, I was thinking at the time that I was going to build a web-based product management application. So I spent the first 2 months after I left talking with product managers about what their needs were. And pretty quickly, I came around to the conclusion that this was going to be too hard, that the project managers I was talking with had wildly varying product requirements for what they would need to meet their needs. So there's a part of the project management prototype that I was putting together that involved taking central logs of instant messages so that people could IM about project requirements, and then those notes would get automatically attached to the product definition. Mm-hmm. And I decided to productize that part of it because it was pretty novel, and I wasn't seeing similar things like it out in the market. So I called it IM Smarter. And it worked for a year and a half on it. That's a pretty cutting-edge technology, but it didn't really take off. It was not particularly well-marketed, and I had spent too much engineering time working on making it fancy and scalable and not enough on making it like just really super obvious and useful for people.
You wanted to be Mac?
Yeah, I was working too hard on making the technology fancy. So, like, as a technologist, you sort of have this belief, not explicitly stated, that if you build cool technology, good things will happen.
Isn't that the same in music where guitarists want to be able to play like the coolest stuff, but then the coolest stuff is what people actually want to listen to?
Yeah, I think you'll find it in any field. But yeah, what the market wants is going to be different than what you want or what you feel like doing. You need to listen to the market. So then realizing that this wasn't really taking off, I had about 5,000 people signed up and using it, but that number wasn't really growing very fast. I started working on some different side projects from I'm Smarter. And one of those side projects, I went and I wrote in a weekend, PPWiki, and I launched, hoping that about a dozen organizations would sign up by the end of the year. And 2 days later, I had like 1,000 organizations signed up. I was like, wow, I need to pay attention to this. So I switched to going full-time on that. And that was in...
So that was the thing where you were just messing around with some code on one weekend, and that's where you got started, and people just started using it.
Yeah. So
now, why are they all going to start using PPWiki rather than using Twiki or some of the others? I mean, there's plenty of wikis out there.
So in June 2005, while there was a lot of different pieces of wiki software that you could install on your server, pretty much all of them had a step one. So you've got your Linux server, And for most people out there who could take advantage of a wiki, for whom a wiki would be useful, they don't have a Linux server that's just sitting around ready to install some software on. Mm. What they wanted was something that they could just go and click and sign up for in a couple seconds, about as much time as it takes to make a peanut butter sandwich, and get their own private hosted wiki, and just not have to worry about any of the servers.
You know, I mean, that's the decision that I made, my decision, too. I mean, I've used Twiki since, like, 2002. I love it. But I made the decision that I wanted to do anything, and that's not my core expertise, and that I want to leverage someone else's expertise, and so therefore I'm not a PPWiki user.
Right. Yeah, I think that pretty much exemplifies our user base. There are people who are smart, and a lot of these people even have the technical competence to be able to go and install and run a wiki service on their own computers, but they've got other things that they're doing. You know, they have other things that they're working on. It doesn't really make sense to be spending a lot of your time doing internal IT working on things that are not your company's focus. It's just a distraction by definition.
Right. So that started off, you got 1,000 users. How did you get those 1,000 users? Was it just people referring to each other? Were you using these to actually drive traffic?
So I mentioned the project to a couple different friends of mine who have blogs, and they wrote it up, and then some of the bigger blogs noted it, and like, hey, this computer science guy went and wrote out this wiki system in a weekend that actually looks half decent. It's very simple, and it's very easy to use. Like, hey, you check it out. And so it started making the rounds very quickly in that sense. And as people signed up for it and started finding it useful, they in turn told other people about it. And in the last 3 years, I mean, we've been experimenting with a lot of different kinds of marketing campaigns, different ways to get word out about PewDieWiki, mm-hmm. but nothing's been nearly as effective as people telling their friends, people who love the product, people who use the product telling their friends.
No, I interviewed Jason Fried. Do you know him?
Remind me who he is.
From 37 Signals?
Yes.
And in his interview, he talked about how a component of all of their products, because they're all collaboration tools, whether it's Basecamp or Campfire or HiRise, they're for working with teams. And so by default, there's a viral growth element built in. Is that maybe a case for what you're doing too?
I think to a degree. I think that if it's useful within the team only, there's a limitation of scope, right? I mean, if there's 10 people on my team and the product works really well for the team, but the product is only viral within the team, then maybe I can get all 10 people using the service really, really quickly. The question is then, you know, what now, right? How do you scale up your growth from there? How do you encourage the members of the team to go and use the service outside of the team? And the way that we address that is we wanted to make a service that was helpful and functional for all sorts of different kinds of purposes. So somebody could go and sign up for a PewDieWiki to go and manage their daughter's softball team, right, and then use that for a couple of weeks. And then get this aha, which we'd hopefully nudge them into, saying, oh, this could actually also be really useful at my work. And they'd go on to bring PewDieWiki to work.
Let me tell you the two uses I've had for that have been really, really profound for PewDieWiki. I'll give you two free testimonials.
Wonderful.
So one is when we publish the interviews, I have a team of about 6 people that work on it all over the world, and so we have a dashboard where it takes the interview process from start to finish, where one person does their job and then they mark it off as done, and then it goes to the next person. So we're basically using it as a step-by-step workflow from recording an interview all the way through to getting it completed. And that's just been a major breakthrough because all these people can be located wherever, and they can all just get in and do their job when they need to. There's very strict parameters around what they have to get done and when they have to get it done, and as long as they fit within those parameters, it just works. And so I'm able to produce an interview every week with a distributed team like that.
Fascinating. That's really awesome.
So that's one.
Using it for lightweight product management.
Yeah. It's, I don't know whether you call it project management or because it's the same thing over and over. Maybe it's more like just a lightweight workflow. Because I was actually doing all of it myself and, you know, emailing all the files back and forth and everything. It was a nightmare. It could have been a full-time job just that. And now we use FTP and PewDieWiki, and it's just perfect.
So awesome.
It's been great. The second one, I'm from Australia, along with other members of my family, we live all over the world. And we had a family holiday over Christmas, and so we were all coming in from everywhere. I live in the Caribbean. One of my brothers lives in Washington D.C. Another one lives in Sydney. Another one's in the army off in Canberra. My parents are in Tasmania. And we had our family PewDieWiki. And what we did was we used it as a calendar. We basically broke down all the days that we were going to be together, and we coordinated as a family all of the different things we were going to do. Like, on this day we're going to meet up with one set of cousins, and on this day we're going to meet up with another set. This day we're going to do that. And so we were able to kind of coordinate together as a family through remotely, through PewDieWiki.
Awesome.
We actually had one drawback with that, when we found it actually in practice, is that we were too efficient, and we ended up burning ourselves out because it was supposed to be a holiday, but we were so efficiently able to pack things in using PewDieWiki that we ended up having kind of a stressful holiday.
Oh, no.
But it really worked. And everybody was able to keep up to date with what was going on and all over the place, and it was just really simple. So thank you for putting up a great product.
Thank you so much.
So so how many users does PewDieWiki have now?
Well, we've got about 4 million people a month who touch the service in some way. We've got about 500,000 people a month who make edits on PewDieWiki, who are engaging the service as an editor. We've got about 500,000 unique communities that exist on PewDieWiki. And we've got, I believe at this point, something north of 2 million unique pages of information hosted on our service.
Okay, so then we'll now go to ask I guess this is the billion-dollar question, is how do you make money? Because I haven't sent you any money.
Yeah. So
I'm sorry, I think you deserve it, but you know, you haven't asked me. Well, I guess you have, but I haven't needed to.
So what we are is we're basically a web equivalent of shareware. So if you're using this service for your own personal uses, that's fine. We're not going to add you too much. If you're using it as a company and you've got more than three people using the service, we're going to start bothering you. We're going to start calling you. We're going to start emailing you. We're going to put messages on your wiki after you've been using it for a while, like, hey, let's have a chat about how you're using BBWiki. So we charge $8 per user per month. That's what we charge businesses to go and use the service. And we've been having a lot of success in rolling this out to companies small and large. There's about 30,000 different businesses that use BBWiki.
With my database account, do I need to be paying on that one?
Well, how many people do you have using it?
I'd say six.
Well, be giving you a call then. Now, your first three seats are free, so we'd be looking to charge you for the next three seats to bring you up to six, which would be $24 a month.
Well, I guess I have them contacted. How come we haven't been contacted?
Well, we're actually just getting a number of these processes in place. Having something in the order of 500,000 communities to go and manage has made it really interesting for us to integrate with Salesforce and to actually start building up a real human Salesforce to integrate with Salesforce. We've got four people who are full-time out in Nashua. Just hired another two people yesterday, actually, who are going through the different kinds of leads that we have put together and scraped together in Salesforce. It's really kind of funny doing the integration because we've ended up bumping up against surprising limitations where Salesforce wasn't really expecting a company with 19 full-time employees to have like 2 million customer records. So it's taken a little interesting juggling there. But we're getting around now to a process where we can take a look at even some of the smaller scale plans that, who are like on your side, who have about 68 people using the service, and be able to reach out to you and say hi and hey, let's talk about getting you upgraded.
And so in a case, I mean, that sort of situation, in a case like mine, what if I don't want to upgrade? How is that going to, 'cause that's going to affect a lot of your users?
Sure. So we do offer pretty steep first-year discounts. We can also have a chat about like, what are you using the wiki for, like how can we make you a success here, what kind of price point makes sense for you. And especially since these are kind of early days for us going in and making sure that this perceived pricing model works well for customers like you, we're willing to be really flexible to make sure that we can give you a solution that makes sense for the kind of budget that you have in mind. For people who are just absolutely unwilling to pay and are using it day in, day out at a company for commercial purposes that have more than three people using it, you know, at that point we ask them to, you know, not use our service. That's actually been fairly rare. At the point that we've got a company that's using our service for business purposes day in, day out, and has a team of people using it and kind of counting on it, they recognize the value that BBWiki brings to their business, and they're willing to discuss with us and have some price point that they're willing to pay.
What will you do if someone else comes along and makes it all free?
I think there's a lot of suspicion about free, because free means kind of reneging on any sort of guarantees. Like, are you going to go and crawl my private data here to try and pull up appropriate ads to go and display me? Are you going to provide me with a service-level agreement that will guarantee that my business-critical data will be available to me? Am I going to be able to email somebody for support or call somebody for support? There's a lot of things that go away with free. Very, very small clients, somebody who might, you know, maybe like a 2-, 3-, or 4-person operation, may be comfortable with that sort of level of whimsy, as it were, but it's not really clear that larger teams with more serious work, with more valuable IT, are willing to just kind of throw it to the wind and just kind of cross their fingers and hope that the provider who's giving them all this stuff for free will continue to give it for free without any strings.
So, because I understood in the beginning, the model that you were trying was forcing people to have start off with public wikis and then running some kind of AdSense on the page, and I guess you'd keep the revenue from that. Did that model not work?
That's not correct. Actually, at the very start, when TWiki started, you could only make private wikis. The ability to create public wikis was something that we added a little later on. We did experiment for about a year or so with running AdSense advertisements on public wikis, but even though we were generating millions of ad deliveries a month, we were not getting anything more than beer money. And it was really clear that this was not going to be a business model that scaled to get us...
Was it beer money and you like to drink more than they pay, or is it just what's only beer money?
Well, you know, we're some good drinkers here at TWiki, so... Yeah, it was pretty clear that in order to get to a business model where we'd be making tens of millions of dollars a year, we'd need unreasonable amounts of traffic, and it was not something that was going to scale. What was scaling at the same time made it really clear for us that people were actually willing to upgrade to subscription payments. And so at some point, almost a year ago, we actually dropped all ads altogether from our service. Just to make it really clear to the world, look, this is our business model. We're a tool. We're selling a tool to people. We're not trying to interrupt you. I don't think that an ad model really makes any sense at all for a business productivity tool. When you're going and searching, when performing an internet search, you're open to finding new information. That's actually very explicitly what you're doing. It's your mental model, right? I'm trying to find out some information about blah, 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 right? And so a company come to you saying, oh, by the way, I can help tell you about blah, blah, blah. You know, and I paid for the rate to go and say that I can tell you about blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
But that's something that a customer is happy to hear, is willing to hear. But if you're in the middle of organizing your team who's transcribing these interviews, for instance, you don't want to hear about an ad for Huggies, right? You don't want to hear about this. you don't want to be presented with ads for different things. You're in the middle of getting your work done.
Yeah.
So an ad is going to be a distraction to you. So we've actually seen this happen, that click-through rates at effective CPMs in non-third contexts perform really incredibly poorly.
Right.
But if you take a look at, like, I mean, this is sort of Facebook's big issue right now, is how to have a better business model than eCPM, because they can go public on their current model. So I think that, you know, as a business productivity tool, it really would not be an effective business model for us to go all ads, let's give away everything for free, and then let's bother the hell out of our users trying to get them to click on ads that have very little to do with what they're working on, and in the process violate the privacy of their intellectual property by trawling through it looking for keywords we can advertise against. That's just not a model I feel like makes sense.
So, I mean, so the model is then paying per user. You've also got a very interesting captive audience there. I remember seeing an email once about a session on using PeerWiki for project management. Are you going to turn that into some sort of training model? I mean, that if you get people training and, you know, could be paid sessions where you might pay $50 to go in and learn how to use PeerWiki with project management and stuff like that, is that something you're looking at? I mean, because with 2 million users, you could do some pretty nice revenue there.
Well, I think that our success long-term is going to come from being able to provide a platform that meets people's needs, that where they've got pain points, they know how to use PeerWiki to go and solve those points of pain. So if we can help PeerWiki succeed at an organization by giving away training for free, even if it costs us a fair amount of money, I think we get ROI on that in a real hurry.
Why would you do it for free when you can charge for it?
Well, you know, it may be something that we explore to have a premium training. I'm not sure that we want to turn into a consultantship because scaling computer resources and computer time is a lot more effective way.
Well, it doesn't have to be because you can still scale because you already have the user base built in. When I saw that you were running a call on project management, I was really interested. Like, you have no idea how interested. But I didn't call in because I'm really busy and I don't really want to be on a free call where I might be being pitched with stuff and I'm not really sure of the caliber of it. If you've got a top guy that's running, you know, $10 million a year of projects or $20 million a year of projects on Wikis, to go in there and train about it, and you charge $50 for the call, I'd pay for it because that's worth my time to go in and listen to it.
Fair enough. You know, that may be something we're looking at. We do archive all of our webinars for free later viewing. So if you wanted to go, if you didn't have a time to go and make that webinar about using PeerWiki for project management, you could come back to it and view the video at any later point.
Are they selling kind of calls, or are they just straight informational?
There's straight information, but what we do is we do collect people's tools information. We follow up with them after. We say, hey, you know, what do you think about the webinar? Would you be interested in using PeerWiki to work?
Hmm. Okay, so what are some interesting uses of PeerWiki? I mean, I've told you some of mine. I'm sure there's some pretty crazy ones out there.
Oh, goodness. We've got such a wild diversity of users. I have mixed feelings about holding a PeerWiki user conference because I'm not sure all of our users would get along. We've got, you know, anarchists. We've got people who run churches based on PeerWiki. We've got people who are putting together, like, erotic fiction novels. We've got the United Nations going and coordinating business responsibility plans. We've got the large tech companies that are going and putting together product safety manuals for internal consumption. We've got advertising agencies that are using PeerWiki to give to their clients, or the clients have got this the latest up-to-date information about how their advertising campaigns are going. The FDA is using PeerWiki in a private project to go and coordinate the development of new medical devices. We've got 3 presidential campaigns that are being run on PeerWiki internally.
You mean actual campaigns being run on PeerWiki? So can you say which ones?
No, I don't think we're actually authorized to disclose which ones. But these include some people still in the running.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah. So there's this wild diversity of folks. I mean, there was this one point where mid last year, I was working on some of the firewall thing rules to go and make sure that some of these more aggressive networks that were trying to hack into our servers were getting blocked out. And I made a little mistake. I fixed it like a few seconds late, but my phone rang. I picked up the phone. It turned out that the Utah legislature was mid-session and was counting on using a PeerWiki for examining their budget and had been briefly shut out for a couple seconds, and they were rather upset. And I apologized to them for it. It was just letting them hang up, and it was just like, whoa. This is really affecting a lot of people. Sometimes it's a real surprise to find out about all the uses that are going on of PeerWiki, not all of which we know about. But one of the really interesting ones is BarCamp. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
So BarCamp is a series of self-organized conferences that happen all around the world on a pretty much continuous basis. It's all organized on PeerWiki. You can go to barcamp.org or barcamp.peerwiki.com. They go to the same place. They're both hosted on PeerWiki. And you can go and set up your own conference talking about whatever subject material you'd like and put together the attendee list and the sponsors list and who's giving what talks. And it's this kind of viral, self-replicating form of a conference.
Hmm.
And there are ones like they're happening almost on a continuous basis all around the world. They've been on almost every continent. I'm not sure there's been a far camp on Antarctica yet, but they're probably working on one.
Right. Well, we're running out of time. Do you have any other things you want to tell us about PeeWiki or what you're doing going forward?
So we've had a couple different market surprises where the people who have shown up to go and use the service have not been the type of people you're necessarily expecting. The biggest case of this, the biggest instance of this, is how popular PeeWiki has been within the education and library sciences space. It turns out, in retrospect, it's kind of obvious. You know, what teachers are looking for is a modern tool that they can use to connect with their students outside the classroom that doesn't require using the computer lab. Because the computer labs in a lot of these schools are like wildly overbooked, so it's an incredibly rare resource. It turns out Wikis are perfect for them. So we've got over 100,000 educators who use PeeWiki to go and provide distance learning, to organize their course curriculum, et cetera. It's a wonderful tool for that. And then for librarians, this stuff is like crack. I mean, you think about what their job is. It's collecting, organizing, disseminating information, and that's precisely what Wiki lets you do in an easy and lightweight fashion. So Wikis have taken off like wildfire within the library communities. And when I started PeeWiki, I did not think that this would be a helpful tool for educators or librarians. But they're the people who show up to the party, so you have to learn to service them, speak in the language, give them case studies, and make sure the product helps them become successful.
Hmm. Cool. Any other points you want to share?
No. Thank you so much for your time.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for doing an interesting interview. I'm glad I finally got a chance to talk to you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Feel free to call me anytime.